I had a serious chat with myself and I said, you don't want to get into law. So I've never heard of recruitment in my life. There were like 24 people in the room and hour by hour, they were dropping like flies. He said, let's rebrand, let's just do this together. And that's how Tail got formed. Thinking outside the box, how you want to get your messaging across, what your messaging is going to be, what your story is going to be. I thought if I ignore this, I'm just always going to regret it by not doing it.
Alexandra Kirica.
Hello.
Welcome to Never Mind the Job Spec.
Thank you so much for having me.
Did you manage to hold your breath?
I really did. I was trying so hard. I'm going to laugh in a second. I'm trying to do it in that direction.
Exactly. This is like, for anybody listening or watching this, this is like a total in-joke.
That only you had to be here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you're a guest, you're in the joke. Otherwise, you're not. But listen, thank you so much, genuinely, for investing your time, because I know how busy you are as a founder at this moment in time, as we were discussing when we inadvertently bumped into each other.
It's a good spot. I'm not surprised you were there.
Exactly. I mean, most founders will find themselves there under the kind of slightly dimmed light of the Hoxton.
Co-working, you just need a desk and good coffee. And that's
exactly. You're going to go, win, and don't give me any sunlight because I'm totally focused right now. And quite poor Wi-Fi, considering, or is that just kind of a fashionable thing? It's like, we struggle with everything as a founder, so therefore we should struggle with Wi-Fi as well.
That is not something I've ever thought about. But if you don't complain about the Wi-Fi at the cafe, then are you even co-working?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, maybe it's a test. They're just kind of like, who is serious
here? A resilience
here. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Another resilience test.
You don't go through enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is just another test on that dial, on that Richter scale of resilience. This just seems like a whole in conversation. People are like, what are you even talking about?
Wi-Fi at the Hoxton.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're just kind of.
Yeah, and we've loosely connected that to the founder's journey.
Yes, I think it's a very important thing to talk about.
It will become very real to everybody as we come through this conversation how important good Wi-Fi is to all of us. Real first world problem. Genuinely, I am excited, and I don't know why I said genuinely there, because it seems as though I'm overemphasizing it. But I really got excited about this conversation because of when we first met in person.
Yes.
And I kind of feel like, hey, I've been, you know, in the audience kind of witnessing your founder's journey from 2019, I figured it out. You were at Aston
Carter.
Yeah, you were at Aston Carter. I was at Remitly. And I was open to meeting kind of any agency
recruiter,
people. Yeah, agency people that really I thought could add value. Because, you know, ultimately for me, I would exit Remitly and they'd need some really good partners.
Yeah.
Now, those really lazy recruiters that just ping me an email and, you know, a deck of stuff. I was just like, okay, cool. Thank you, but no thanks.
Yeah.
But individuals that were a little bit more tenacious, like you, I was like, hey, I've got to meet this person. Even if it could be a situation where I could flip you and you could be the future of Remitly's kind of, I don't know if you remember in that conversation.
I do remember. I said, that you've brought it back, was it during a transition period between Aston Carter and Broadgate? I can't remember.
Yeah, it would have been. It would have been right on that. Because at the time, I think, if I remember correctly as well, you were going to get your citizenship.
Yes. Yeah,
you were,
exactly.
You were kind of getting ready for that as well.
I'm British.
Yeah.
No.
Yay.
Hooray.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Got my citizenship and we've just exited Europe. Damn it. Anyway, that's a whole other conversation. Yeah, but yeah, I remember that distinctly in 2019. I was like, and when you meet really what I call and what I class as really great agency kind of recruiters who are a lot more commercial, a lot more business savvy, you're kind of like, okay, you know, you keep a track on those people because they will become part of your network.
Yeah.
So.
And then I didn't see you again until the networking event. I remember we both just looked at each other like, Jesus Christ, we've both done so much in the past couple of years because it was just before COVID hit as well.
Absolutely, yeah. There was one other online event that I was doing a panel-based thing. And I was, and basically the organizer went, one of our main speakers has pulled out. So we can pull together an extended panel and fill about an hour. I was like, yes. And it was yourself, Lewis Maller, and another, I can't remember who that was. And we basically just went on and just talked for an hour about kind of recruitment and talent acquisition. Hey.
And look at us again.
Exactly.
We're different topic, but
different topic indeed. But in terms of, for people that don't know you, that haven't seen your TikTok mm-hmm. content, Insta content, LinkedIn content, which is some of it is really quite funny now, which is a brief introduction, please, Alex.
Brief introduction. Well, I'm Alexandra Kirika. I started off working in contract recruitment. I had a recruitment agency myself called Tail, where I focused on anti-financial crime recruitment for fintechs. And then 5 months ago, I launched RecFinder. That's me.
Boom, boom. And we will definitely get into every element of that. I am interested, as I ask all guests.
Yes.
Graduating from Warwick Uni.
Yes.
Degree in English Literature.
Yeah. Well,
what did you expect the world to offer, Alex?
With an English lit degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I kind of, from the age of 15 to my final year of uni, my main goal was to go and do law.
Wow.
That's always been the path in my head. I want to go and study law. I want to go and be a lawyer. And then the intention with the English lit degree was to eventually do a law conversion.
Okay, yeah, makes
and,
good sense.
Yeah, and I remember them saying, you know, you need to have a Russell Group University and study your humanities, and then after that you can convert and do an LPC or something like that. And in my final year of uni, I had a serious chat with myself, and I said, you don't remotely want to get into law. And because I've spent all those years just focusing on good grades, good uni, law being the path, I genuinely found myself very lost. At that point, I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do? I have a literature degree and I have no idea what to do other than become an English teacher. And that was it. I didn't know.
I'm now just imagining that pathway.
Yeah, exactly.
Into teaching. So you effectively removed your own North Star.
Yeah, literally. And then I spent that summer traveling and I was reading all these different news articles about, you know, students not getting employed for 6 months. And I went traveling for only 3 weeks. And then my dad says to me, why haven't you got a job yet? I was like, oh my God. So
easy, dad.
Right? So the stubbornness in me just said, I'm going to show you how I'm going to get employed immediately.
Oh, smart dad. So
annoyingly clever, because then I posted my CV onto all the websites on everything. So I didn't really know what I wanted. And I got a call up saying, from a rec to rec. Now, bear in mind, I had no idea what a rec to rec was. They just said to me, we're having an assessment day. And if you're successful, we will work with you to get a job. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. They're going to get me a job. So I go to this assessment day. I made it through the finals as if it was bloody Dragon's Den or something. And then they said, oh, we've actually got 3 interviews lined up for you. I'm like, what? No context to what the job is, right?
Oh, okay. Well,
I wasn't
useful.
Told.
Okay.
I didn't know. And then they said, this one is for selling software. I think it was Softcat or something like that.
Okay, yeah, cool.
And the other one was Aston Carter. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, that sounds lawyery, you know? Yeah, yeah. That sounds like a fancy name. So then Aston Carter had a whole day assessment as well. Now, this was back to back. It was literally like, did it on a Wednesday, went to Aston Carter the next day. And I had to show up there at 8 in the morning. And there were like 24 people in the room. And hour by hour, they were dropping like flies until by 6 p.m. it was just me and this one other girl that survived the day. And we got offered the job. And it was only during the day that I realized what this job actually was. Because I've never heard of recruitment in my life.
Yeah.
And that's how they roped me in. I genuinely think that's how that rec to rec roped me in.
I mean, knowing what you know now, if a rec to rec phoned you now and said, hey, would you want to come through one of our assessment days? What would your response be?
Oh.
A polite decline, maybe?
I would have asked more questions to know, well, what is this? What am I signing up to? I think because I wanted a job so badly, I didn't really care. I just thought, oh, looks like a very big corporate firm. My dad will be happy with this. Let's go. And that was it. I think I wouldn't change anything about what happened because it's brought me on the journey that I'm on. But if I had to redo life again, I would, ironically, I know that there's a stereotype about like English lit degrees going into marketing. And I thought, I'm never going to do that.
Mm.
And now here I am like, oh my God, I wish I did go into marketing.
Well, I mean, I would venture you are your one person marketing team. So, I mean, invariably you have gone into marketing.
I have gone into marketing, exactly. Yeah.
Whether you look at it in a traditional sense or not, you have gone into marketing. That's really interesting, actually, that they, and I think that was quite indicative of the time, that the kind of large agency approach of, should we say, kind of screening out people so they got to the individuals that ultimately they wanted to offer a job to. And what was your general impression during that day? And this is not to kind of be specific to Ashton Carter in any way, shape, or form, because this was kind of quite an industry standard. But just that experience of kind of going through a bit of an assessment center, as it were. I mean, do you look back on that time and pick out certain experiences or certain points where you were like, okay, or is it just quite literally the point where you were like, oh, and this is the job?
I'll be honest, I fell for it completely, in the sense that I loved everything about it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's because I was walking down those corridors, and bear in mind, I wanted to get into law. So what did I watch on repeat? Suits.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm walking through this office, everyone's in suits. I'm thinking, oh my God, I didn't go into law, but hey, this is giving me a similar vibe to this. This is pretty cool. And then I loved all the interviews. I think I spoke to about 6 different people, and I loved it. I was very competitive. I am very competitive.
I was just going to say, is this not about you and your desire to meet a challenge? You were just like, each interview is not an interview. It's a challenge.
It's a conversation. Why should I come here?
Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely loved it. And not arrogantly, but I just thought, yeah, there's no way that I'm going to fail because I'm just talking to you. And I'm being very honest about what I want. And they were trying to be, you know, very serious about it. And I just, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I think it got to the point that I got competitive about it, even though I didn't even know if it was a job I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I was just that competitive, as I got it anyway.
Nice. Did the other person get a job as well?
Yes. So we both started together at the company. And then they looked to see, you know, where is there a spot in the team? And it was completely by chance that you get into the industry that you recruit in.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of, they probably had in mind the particular areas or verticals that they would want to align you to. They just needed somebody with that kind of, like say, that competitiveness. And I think that's a consistent thing, certainly agency side.
Mm.
You very rarely work with somebody that doesn't have that kind of competitive instinct.
Yeah.
Whether it's healthy competitive or just kind of destructive competitiveness, they are competitive.
Absolutely.
But there is a buzz that comes from that. It's kind of like, if you like competition and you're into sports and stuff like that, or you just like that kind of intellectual challenge. And yes, there is an intellectual challenge in recruitment, folks. You know what I mean? It's very much so if you approach it the right way.
There really is.
Yeah. And there is a pathway. Some people might look at it as a kind of 12 months, let's make some cash and then bounce out. What was your vision for yourself at Ashton Carter once you'd secured that job?
What was my vision for Ashton Carter? I think I am a bit of a perfectionist, and I wanted to do as well as I possibly could, but I also challenged a lot of things. And trying to challenge a business that's global and you are a junior consultant, the only person that I challenged was my manager. And it was tiny things like, why do we have to do it this way? This way doesn't make sense. So I was constantly aggravated by these tiny things. And I had to remind myself, like, you know what, Alex, you need to sit the hell down. You have no experience here. You need to get off your moral high horse.
Yeah.
But I could see that very early on, that I was constantly picking apart at things that didn't make sense to me.
And what were those things?
What
were they centered on largely? Was it around the candidate experience, the client engagement? Was it just about how the the model operated within the team or?
Yeah. So for instance, and firstly, I just want to say that it was the best training ground that I could have ever had. I think as much as I didn't like some things that we did or some of the practices that we all know in recruitment happen, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here without that training ground, having gone through it. And it was, I remember we would sit around a table during our training and they would give us a script of things of, you know, why we would need to say certain stuff, you know, like lead generation, you know, ask them where they're interviewing. So then you know, oh, who's the hiring manager? If you get three names of hiring managers, then you do X, Y, Z.
Invariably, you never got those either. I mean, not consistently anyway.
Yeah.
People are pretty savvy.
And I thought, I think what I really liked about the questions was the psychology of it. I thought, oh, this is, I like that part of it, that you can get people to trust you, but then you're really, you know, abusing that trust if you're just there to take the information. So there were aspects of it that I enjoyed, which is, you know, learning how to get the information, but abusing that, that's the part that I wasn't a fan of.
Yeah. Your kind of moral compass kicks in, right? Because it's kind of like if you build trust, you build or you establish a base to enable yourself to ask those questions and that person will give that freely. Then what you do with that information, that's the next bit. It's kind of almost like, are you using that information to then go on and do something valuable or is it to exploit a commercial opportunity? And I guess your morals will guide you on that, right?
Exactly. Or if you're, you know, you're shooting the candidate in the foot because they're applying for that job and now you want to go in and steal it and you think, yeah, well, that's also my candidate. And it just got messy. And I think I struggled with those aspects.
I can totally align with that. I think, again, the agency I worked in, similar sorts of practices. You'd have the kind of corporate accounts team that didn't typically do that, mm-hmm. but you would have what they called the kind of new accounts team that were pure new business development. So something like that for them was ideal. You know, say for instance, Alex is interviewing tomorrow at X company and they've said that they're, you know, the hiring manager is X. They'd be on the phone saying, oh, look, I know you've got interviews coming up, but why don't I send two or three?
I thought they'd be at the building, knocking down.
Yeah, it's almost like, here's two or three other people that we think are just as good as that person you're seeing.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that was quite a common practice. And I struggled with the idea of that.
Yeah.
You're essentially, you know, kind of abusing that trust and that relationship you built with somebody.
Exactly. And then fake jobs. Because then if you get fake jobs, then candidates will apply and then you speak to the candidates and then the candidates will give you information about where else they're interviewing. So I get why candidates and people don't like recruit. I get it.
Mm.
But spreading the message that not everyone is like that.
Yeah.
I think you need to show it through your values. I know you're very big on values and you need to show it through your actions and promote good practices.
Yeah, I think so. And like you, I found agency side a fantastic training ground.
Mm.
Love the people I work with.
Yeah.
Some incredible individuals I'm still friends with now, very good friends. But we were talking about this prior to the podcast, that is there a point where you start to want more? You want more in terms of kind of fulfillment and perhaps you know, that early signs of you, why do we do it like this? And why can't we do it like that? You want that kind of opportunity to explore and implement those types of practices to see if they do work. And so Aston Carter, great training ground, and then you went on to Broadgate.
I did.
And was that the reason? More wanted to do something different because you basically set up a whole desk there, right? A whole new vertical for them.
Yeah. So I wanted to go into perm because at Aston Carter, I did contracts.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And I think I kind of realized I really want to try permanent recruitment because I think my personality is a bit more suited to it. And to this day, I think if you are trained in contract, you will be a better permanent recruiter. And I will die on that hill.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you understand the value of speed.
Definitely.
And I remember seeing some of the perm recruiters, even at AC, where they were taking weeks. I was like, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't have CVs in 24 hours? Because it was just like that in contract.
Yeah.
And going there to do anti-financial crime, because it was what I focused on, I also realized I wanted to focus more on fintech. And it was actually roughly around the time where you were seeing the payments companies and the remittance companies and Remitly. And then you had World Remit and all of these bigger payments businesses. Mm-hmm. And once you're in that area, you naturally go down this route of discovering the fintechs.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure.
And I remember Curve. Do you know Curve?
Yeah, I remember meeting the CEO of Curve. Yeah, yeah.
Shahar? I remember seeing them. I thought, oh my God, this is, I love their branding. There was the creative director there called Katie. And I remember I sent her a message on LinkedIn, even though it was not my space. I just said, I absolutely love everything that you're doing for this company. So then started working with Curve. But the way that they worked was so different to a hedge fund, an asset management company, that there was no phone to pick up to them.
Yeah.
There's no phone number at all. So what do? You write sarcastic messages or emails to grab their attention, or you WhatsApp them.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
If you do have their number, you WhatsApp. You don't.
Yeah, exactly. He was, I remember, as I said, met the CEO of Curve. He was like, you got 25 minutes. I don't usually meet recruiters. I was like, cool. And the only reason he met me was because I leveraged more on my interest in payments than I did on anything to do with recruitment. And we had a really lively conversation over 25 minutes that I thought was really interesting to get his perspective.
Yeah.
But that to your point, that was the only route to kind of get these individuals' kind of attention. Because if you went with, oh, you know, we do contingent or retained, they'd just be like, I haven't got time for that. I'm not interested.
They don't care.
You're not selling me anything valuable there.
Yeah.
Where's the value for me and my business and my rapidly scaling business?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't even show me a level of interest and understanding of the marketplace I'm in or the new marketplace I'm in that's developing, you're never going to be able to find the talent I need.
Which is completely fair.
Yeah,
and I think it really helps when you like the business that you're recruiting for.
Yeah, exactly that.
I mean, I don't want to say this, but I will. It was a very painful business to work with at the time. This was a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I stuck it out because I just loved them,
what they
stand for and what they did and how they did it. I just stuck with it, which goes to show, you know, if you truly like the business that you're recruiting for, you will go above and beyond and deal with all the stuff
that
they, throw your way.
All those payment companies seem to have a very similar type of culture, which is our requirements will change very quickly. Yes, you've been looking for this particular role for the last 2 months. We don't need that now. You need to find
months.
Us this.
Yeah, exactly. Months, yeah. Weeks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's kind of almost like, you need to find us this now.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that. We'll come back to that later.
Yeah.
And that is contrary to the typical type of cycles you have with like the large insurance asset managers. You know, it's a very, straightforward linear process. We will hire this person, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to kind of absorb some of the changing requirements.
Yeah.
And just smile. And be like, okay, cool. I'm going to put all the energy that I just put into that last few weeks. I'm going to put it all into this now.
I think that there's smiling, and I did this more in tail, but you learn to put your foot down a little bit more after that, because you just think, or you do it right at the beginning. So when I was doing anti-financial crime for tail, I had a lot of founders who got told by the FCA that they need to hire an MLRO. And they have a 60K budget. And then they would get referred to me and I would just have to sit them down. It's like, first of all, you don't need an MLRO. You need a head of compliance because you want your license. Now, after you get your license, then your risk is going to be in payments. Then you need an MLRO. It's like putting your foot down and rejecting business to get more business later on. Because you've just demonstrated your value by educating them.
Yeah, for sure. And that payment space as well, sorry.
The
kind of compliance piece was super critical, right? I mean, sometimes, like you say, the kind of the leadership team will be sitting down in front of the FCA or whichever kind of regulatory body in that country, and they needed that person in place or else things were going to get quite challenging quite quickly.
Yeah, I think not that I fell lucky into this, but you find once I realized that, oh, fintechs need this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If they want to deal with money in the UK, you need this. So that became like my BD outreach.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, oh, I noticed you don't have a license.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to need one.
Yeah, smart, really smart. Because ultimately, like I say, you're delivering a solution either that's right-sized right now or one that they will ultimately want and need in the future.
Yeah.
You're showing credibility by understanding. You're showing value.
Mm.
And again, you're not even talking about recruitment. Specifically, no. the how will I recruit this person? That bit is not even part of the conversation.
Yeah.
It's like, you're a business and you need this, and I know you need it because I've worked with all these other businesses and they've needed it as well.
And if you don't, you're going to get fined.
Yeah, exactly.
So you tell me where you want to spend your money.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of like the cost of the recruitment fee or the rather large cost of being fined.
Yeah.
I know which one I'd probably opt for. There are my terms to sign there.
We don't need to jump on a call.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't worry about a call. I know what you're looking for. Just sign the document. So, I mean, Broadgate sounds like, again, it gave you another experience, like contractor permit. I agree with you. I started in contract. Man, seriously, it was great fun.
Yeah.
And I used to look at the perm recruiters and think, what are you doing? Whereas we go out, you go out to lunch and then everybody get a message. We've just had a couple of requirements in from X. Everybody comes back from lunch straight in, on the phones and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So Broadgate gave you that other side, that kind of, if you will, that dual desk, the perm side. But the same token, that was, by the looks of it, roughly just over a year?
Yes.
So when did tail start to come into your mind? Or you were like, actually, I'm generating a lot of business for Broadgate.
Well, it was, I think Broadgate gave me the chance to play around with different avenues of BD and what I wanted to do. Like, they let me host an event, which went really, really well.
Wicked.
And different things like this. I remember just going directly to the CEO and going like, hey, I have ideas. Can we please sit down about this? And he gave me the time of day. I was consultant, but it was just nice that there was no hierarchy there and I could just go and have those conversations. And I was really grateful for that. And something just didn't sit with me. And I remember I actually got a job offer in Miami. I was going to move to Miami.
Wow.
Which is the only reason I got my British passport.
Yeah, it makes sense, yeah.
And I was flipping my entire world upside down to go to Miami to do pharmaceutical recruitment. I thought, what the hell? I wasn't satisfied with something and I didn't know what that was.
Wow, hello, left field.
So apparently, my solution was to just move to Miami for God knows what reason.
Could think of worse places to go.
Yeah. Agreed. And then I got my citizenship February 2020.
Ah.
And I had my job offer as well in February 2020. 2 weeks after I had rejected the job offer, COVID gets announced. So it was a blessing in disguise. I got a British passport out of it. Great.
Mm.
Which I had to do, otherwise I was never really going to do it. But then I was in the UK and I never went to Miami. And I think I didn't want to lose the relationships that I had in the fincrime network.
It's an interesting space, right?
Love it.
Pharmaceuticals.
It was just too different. And it's also starting from scratch. And I thought, why am I really doing this? So I had to have a serious chat with myself. And then things got tough. Recruitment businesses got tough and people got furloughed. Metrics were increased. I think everyone was going through a very panicky period, understandably so. And I had this guy on LinkedIn who dropped me a message. He has his own company. He's 26. He's looking for someone to join.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, mate, you do pharma. I can't. This is what I do. And he said, no, I want to rebrand. I want to do whatever. And I was like, okay, let's have a call.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was 25. He was making a crap ton of money being a lifestyle recruiter. So he said, you know, let's rebrand. Let's just do this together. I'll give you 3 months' salary up front. And then, you can pay me back as you bill.
Yeah.
And that's how Tail basically got formed. Wow. Through me and Harry never meeting. Mm-hmm. To this day, we have still never met.
Yeah.
But he was very impulsive. I was impulsive because I had no risks attached to this mm-hmm. at all. And I got the decision on the branding, the name, and it didn't work for him. So we're still very close now, but because he did pharma, the brand was a little bit too casual for that industry.
Yeah, I can see knowing the branding of Tail, that would be, it almost appear as a bit of a counterculture to kind of pharmaceutical. It's a lot more traditional, a lot more, yeah. I mean, from a color perspective.
Absolutely.
You know, kind of clinical colors probably are the standard there, whereas Tail was very, it was very you.
Pink and blue.
Yeah, I mean, it's got that color, that vibrancy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And immediately they'd be like, wow, is this a marketing agency or a recruitment agency? I'm not too sure.
It was very me, and I was so happy that he let me go with this.
Yeah.
And then that's how I kind of got brought out. I had no intention of ever launching my own agency, nothing like that. Mm. Harry gave me the opportunity and I thought, why not? I spoke to my parents. They said, hell yeah, why not? Mm. You're at home anyway. It's COVID.
Yeah.
There's any time to risk it all. It's during COVID. Yeah, apparently. Exactly. Yeah.
You're like, all your chips in. Let's go. Gamble. All on red, thank you. It's interesting that I think, from my recollection, Tail was, for me, probably the first time I started to see you really focus on your personal branding as well. So Tail was almost, there is Tail, this business, but you were very much in front of it.
Hmm.
Your kind of personality, the way that you presented your kind of thoughts on the Fincry market, just, you know, your general sort of tales of working in Tail. And was that a conscious decision, or you just felt like, okay, this seems to fit?
No, it was, I've never heard about personal brand before. I had no idea that was a thing. In 2020, don't remember that being spoken about. It was never a focus. And the only thing I remember is that I was talking to candidates constantly because I was trying to help them with their CVs in preparation for when they're going to get employed. And the same pattern of issues were coming up again and again and again. And I was getting frustrated with the lack of knowledge or lack of information accessible to these candidates. And I thought, if I do a video sharing this information and more than one person sees it, you've technically saved me a 45-minute call.
Yeah, okay.
In doing this. So my benchmark was, if this is useful for at least one person because I've posted this, fantastic. Great. And that was the intention. It was at the beginning, it was literally CV tips all the time, or what the market is saying, or the trends and what's happening. And it got engagement because I actually don't think there were recruiters posting anything.
Then. Fast forward to now. I mean, now there's a proliferation of CV tips. TikTok recruiters and everything along those lines. But this is my point. I think at the time I saw that, I was like, that's really useful. For me personally, I looked at it, I was like, that's very candidate-centric, that's very human-centered. That's you sharing your knowledge to help people. Because there was no, oh, and if you want more, you know, kind of DM me and there's a whole pack
subscribe
you can buy.
To this.
Exactly, yeah. It was just kind of, this is free information and I hope it's helpful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think, did you even think of it in these terms? Did that help the brand scale its awareness? Did you get referrals off the back of just being just a genuinely nice human being in recruitment?
I know some people think that it's really difficult to measure the ROI of videos, but the referrals that I used to get, and the fact that if I cold messaged someone automatically, if they have seen one of my videos, it takes that message from cold to near hot.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they message back saying, oh, I've seen your videos. And it just removes that barrier in between. It's like, oh, we've never actually spoken. They usually don't even like my stuff on LinkedIn. That's the thing I don't understand. But they've seen me there. And you build familiarity.
Yeah.
And that familiarity is so important. I think it genuinely is. And then obviously, yeah, referrals. If you constantly are banging on about the same thing, and I was talking about financial crime, that's all people are going to remember you for, which for business, if that's what you do, then brilliant.
Perfect. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's always interesting that with kind of social media, there's the active minority and the quiet majority.
Yes.
And I think people focus so much on the active minority of people that are, you know, likes, comments, shares, all that sort of thing. There's a whole massive majority of people that, like you say, don't interact in any way, shape or form. You wouldn't even know that they'd seen your profile.
Yeah.
But actually, you get that validation when they're like, oh yeah, I've seen your content. Like, look, we're not even connected. They've never even commented on any of my posts. So I think there's always that kind of, I think you, certainly from a personal brand perspective, and like you say, measuring ROI, sometimes you won't see that ROI until it actually materializes. And just tracking what's happening with that kind of active minority is probably not the complete picture, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I think it's the community aspect
for sure.
As well. I mean, there are people who have been commenting on my stuff for the past couple of years, and some of the messages that I get from them are so lovely. And even if I post something and then they reply back with, oh, I remember when you were at Aston Carter or this, it's like, crap, that means a lot because you've been here for years or we've been connected and you've had that community. So I'll never stop talking about personal brand. I think it's by default become something that I do religiously.
Yeah. And I'm keen to explore that just a little bit more before we kind of focus on RecFinder specifically. It's, do you think about different channels in terms of different approaches? Because you're active on TikTok, Insta, you know, and some of the TikTok stuff is just generally your thoughts about life
stuff.
And the day. And it's kind of, it's almost like a journal.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a window into your mind on, you know, and that authenticity, I think, really resonates positively with people.
Yeah.
Well, it's a case in point, you know, if I see you ping up, I was like, this is either going to be informative or fun, right? Now, if I have that in my mind and, you know, multiply that by 100, 1,000, 10,000, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
People are like, okay, this is going to offer value to me.
Yeah.
Or I'm just going to feel good. Actually, that's a pretty powerful kind of, you know, quote unquote tool, you know?
Yeah.
So do you think of it in a strategic sense? Are there certain messages that you intentionally put on certain channels, or is it just kind of like, well, whatever I'm thinking at the time and whatever, you know, app I click into?
Firstly, I'll start off with, because it feeds into all of the content that I do. The biggest compliment that I have, and people say this to me without realizing that they're paying me a compliment, is when they say that I'm not different in person to the stuff that I put online.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And that to me means so much because I'm not trying to be anything different. So there are, especially on Instagram, I will have a random thought and I thought, oh, maybe someone else has had this thought. And I'll just put it, there's more swearing on my Instagram that I naturally cannot put on LinkedIn, of course.
Slight filter.
Yeah. And there's a strategy in terms of what do I want to be known for on LinkedIn?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the content that I'm going to put on there? And then what do I want to do on Instagram? I think the Instagram one is definitely more social. It's my day to day. It can be my family, my brother, my friends. It's me working from home, dancing around after a really good phone call that I've had.
Mm.
And TikTok, I struggle with TikTok because it's a combination of both.
Yeah.
It's a combination of the silly, the authentic, and then the value add.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I don't know if you've seen the recruitment horror stories
that I've been doing. Yeah.
So now that my audience has changed, the people that I'm trying to be in front of has changed, has been a massive hit from a community standpoint, because now I need to think of the things that I want to speak about that's going to relate to these people, to my audience, or the people I want to connect with. And I remember being in the studio and thinking, huh, what's going to be something that is funny, is relatable, appeals to recruiters and anyone doing recruitment? And there, the recruitment horror stories was born, where it's just a very fine line that can appeal to Instagram, to TikTok, to LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. Was it thought out? Not really. It's just having that creative thing. We're just kind of thinking, if you're an audience member, what do you want to listen to? Yeah. What do you want out of it? I'm not intentionally funny. My friends usually laugh at me rather than with me. So I wish there was more structure to the chaos of of content, but yeah.
I think it's interesting what you touched upon at the top there, is just that authenticity.
Yeah.
Who you are on kind of in the social media world is exactly who somebody would meet on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. you know, client would meet, et cetera. And I think your point around just being creative on social media, I get you. It's almost like LinkedIn, you do have to rein it in a little bit because of the filters they actually apply. So if there's too much swearing and stuff like that, they'll, you know, kind of bury your content, if not give it any light at all. But with, you know, kind of Insta and TikTok, you can be a bit more playful and, to your point, kind of just run with some ideas. Yeah. I mean, you might be like, okay, well, this might be 3 or 4 posts. It might be 10, it might be 20, who knows? But let's give it a go and let's find out. And let's see if it just resonates with people on a human basis. And let's be fair, there is almost a human element to, we like to hear things like horror stories, don't we? Because it makes us feel good and it's probably quite funny as well. Where do you source them in from? Is that sort of stuff that you've experienced yourself and you're being really polite by repackaging it and not naming any names? Is it stuff that's just kind of getting fed to you now that you've started to share some of your maybe horror stories? People are like, oh my God, yeah. And they're sending stuff your way now to kind of see on there.
Basically that.
Wicked.
I don't think I've had any terrible horror stories.
Are there some that you've not been able to read out, or you've seen and you're like, there's no way we can put this out there?
Some of them are just,
somebody's going to get sued.
Yeah. There were a couple where I thought, okay, there's no way of me making this funny because it's actually not.
Yeah.
It's actually not funny. This is really traumatic and serious and horrible. And then there's other situations, and I think women in recruitment would have definitely experienced this, which is not really a horror story, but, you know, I remember being 21 and I went to a very big bank and I had a meeting with someone and they were significantly older than me. And it was a client lunch. And then they were trying it with me inappropriately. And you think these stories are horror stories. And I wish it was spoken about a lot more, because should I need to have my male director come with me to these meetings? And do I even want to work with that client anymore?
Exactly.
Where's the line? You know, do you want to reject this really big client because of this? Or I mean, you're 21 as well. It's a difficult decision for you to make because it's horrible. And I highly think I'm not the only one that's been in that situation.
It's an interesting point you make. I think, you know, certainly when I was working agency side, there was always a minority of females working in that kind of boiler room, very male dominated environment. Everybody has the right to feel safe wherever they work.
Yeah.
But to your point, the reality is there's a business element there that's like, they're almost like, well, you know, that maybe there was a miscommunication and therefore then we can still partner with this rather large investment bank, et cetera. And that's disappointing because it comes back to that moral piece, right?
Yeah.
In terms of where is your moral compass when it comes to this? Is
is winning business at the, you know, and sacrificing the potential feeling of safety of an individual that you have a responsibility to as an employee.
Yeah.
You know, you just, it just calls into question a lot of issues that I don't think are specific to kind of recruitment or necessarily banking, but probably more broadly. But to your point, you know, you have the right to feel safe wherever you work.
Absolutely. And I think in a sales capacity, there should be just values and rules that say, you know what, we will not work with you if this happens, plain and simple.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or my question now to businesses would be, what are you doing to educate the women in your business when they go to these meetings as part of the sales training? What are you doing? Because the conversation is going to look very different from if a man is there or if it's not.
For sure. I think it's education and empowering. It's as simple as, if you feel uncomfortable, if you feel like you've got to compromise your professional integrity to win this business, leave.
Yeah.
And so imagine, we do not need that kind of business.
And it's having that reassurance that the business will back you. Because, and I don't want to make assumptions because I never did it, so I don't know what would happen. But if I did come back and say, yep, we lost that entire client because they did this, and then I got reprimanded for that.
The fact that you don't know.
No.
Talks to probably the environment that's created, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of almost like if you're kind of like, well, I don't know how that go down. It could fall either side depending on the fee, basically. You're just kind of like, oh my God.
It's a 50 grand fee. Yeah. What are we doing? Yeah. No, you're right.
It's an interesting kind of sidebar in the conversation because it does, maybe, I don't know if it does, but now that you're a founder and you control the culture and the environment that your business defines.
Yeah.
You absolutely have that final say in terms of the types of customers that you and clients that you will work with. I'm not saying that informed your founder journey, but actually it does. It's what all females should have, whether they're working in a business or working for themselves, is that choice.
Yeah, definitely. I think your tolerance level just, you get to choose ultimately. Mm. And what I found at the very beginning of Tail, and it was a learning process, the amount of people that want to waste your time.
They just want to talk to you.
They just want to talk to you. Or they want you to go for coffees. Yeah. Or they want you, you know, whatever. And I remember just thinking, absolutely the hell not. I need you to tell me, what are we discussing?
Yeah.
What is the purpose of this coffee? And you just come, not become, you are very direct. Like, this is my time.
Yeah.
And sure, we can forge a relationship here, but on what grounds?
Yeah.
What's...
I'm not a free career counselor. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, this is not therapy. Tail sounded to me like absolutely where you were going to land in terms of, you know, essentially starting your own business.
Mm-hmm.
Most people probably would have been quite happy with that, right? I mean, you know, kind of then thinking about a tech platform, probably would be like, okay, well, maybe we'll give us a bit of breathing space and we'll come to that once, you know, we've got investors on board, et cetera, et cetera. At what point did you start to think about RecFinder? I mean, and just for everybody's context, what is RecFinder?
So RecFinder is a platform for fintechs and startups to go and match with the right individual recruiter for the niche that they're hiring for. So in a very Bumble format, the recruiter can't speak to you or reach out to you unless you've matched with them. And the recruiters are also limited to 3 different areas that they recruit in. So you cannot be a jack of all trades on the platform whatsoever. The point being that, you know, by the time the hiring manager has gone there and they've matched with you, it's been qualified to a point that, you know, they're only on the platform for one reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gotten in touch with you directly because they are looking to hire in cyber, for instance.
Wicked.
And it's bringing the attention to the individual recruiters that are now dominating the recruitment market.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's more micro businesses starting up every single week.
There is, 100%.
So yeah, that's
I like
it
that.
Is.
I love the simplicity of it. I like the time-saving element of it. So it's kind of hiring manager, if they're making contact, it's like, we're going to do some business.
Yeah.
And I've looked at your profile. You look like you can deliver the service that I need. Let's have a conversation that is not a half an hour coffee and we don't know really what it's about. And when did I try to figure, when did you actually formally launch? Because you started RecFinder back in 2023, October 20th, so kind of Q4, but I, you know, like most startups, it starts before that. So yeah. when did you actually go, okay, beta launch, beta launch, we're out. Here you go. You can jump on board the platform now.
February this year.
Okay, cool.
February 2024, when it was all launched, it's live, it was working.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea popped up February 14th, 2021.
Mm-hmm.
It was 9 months into tail.
Okay. How? I mean, that's the kind of thing that really overlap there. I mean, there's one thing to have the idea. Why did you pursue that idea?
Well, I slept on it for sure. Yeah. I parked it. I was trying to get rid of it at the back of my head, but the problem was coming up and up and up again and again. Yeah. And the problem being that the fintechs that I was speaking to, I would place the head of compliance in MLRO and they would come back and say, hey, can you find us a CTO? I don't know what the hell that stands for. I don't know what that is.
You're like, that sounds nice. No.
Good luck.
Yeah,
sure.
All the best.
And I would try and help them in the sense of getting another agency. Have you ever tried typing in recruitment consultant on LinkedIn and the searches that come up?
I can remember typing in recruitment consultant or recruiter in Google. It wouldn't, the first few search options wouldn't take you directly to a company. But yeah, like you said, it's like the Wild West, right? It's like so many
options. Yeah. And I think the difference being, because I spent little time in agency, I spent 3 years in total in agency. I didn't give myself the time to build a network with recruiters. Whereas people who start agencies when they're, I don't know, mid-30s or whatever, you had already a whole 15-year career where you know that John from Skills is now doing X they specialize in that.
Yeah. If you've been in it 20 years, right? And you kind of been around for a while. Yeah, those type of people.
Well, yeah, but you have a network, right? Of who to go to. But then, even then, you'll know who to ask or you'll know where to go. It's like, hey guys, someone's asked me for a cyber person. Do you know anyone here who does this?
I think the key thing is you know who's good.
Yeah.
You know who's reliable. You know who will deliver a good quality solution service based on the need. But equally, it helps you to identify people that you think could be really good as well that may just not have had the opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that's the value out of being around as long as I have. So back to RecFinder though. So it's an idea you've tried to bury in the back of your subconscious. You're kind of like, oh my God, you know, no, not now. They just set up tail. You know what I mean? It's not even a year yet. What was the catalyst for you to pursue that idea? Could you just not ignore it anymore?
I thought if I ignore this thing at the back of my head, I'm just always going to regret it by not doing it.
Or somebody else will build it.
And it's going to sound so stereotypical and eat, pray, love, but I went to Bali for a month.
Cool.
In 2022. And after that entire trip, I just came out of it saying, screw this.
Let's go.
Let's go. What's the worst thing that can happen? You are going to learn so much. You're going to meet incredible people. You're going to learn more about the industry. You're going to learn what works, what doesn't work, what you can do to improve. I'm struggling to see a downside of going on this journey. Mm. And then I learned about tech.
So, yeah, I mean, that founder's journey, and I've, you know, like I say, I feel like I'm slightly cheating the audience because we had a whole conversation around this prior to coming on air. But it's kind of, for you, what have been the kind of real highlights of the founder journey, and what are the bits that have been slightly more challenging? And I know that's a kind of two-tier question and quite a lot in that. I while you're thinking, let me just kind of introduce this idea. I'm going to give a shout out to Logan McGregor, who coined this phrase. He was like, being a founder is being asked to walk on glass barefoot before you can put shoes on. How's that?
That's brilliant.
How's that?
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Logan McGregor, hat tip to him on that. But
yeah.
Back to the question. It's kind of from a founder point of view, what has surprised you about the journey? What has surprised you in a slightly more challenging way?
What was surprising? I think in hindsight, the build was the easy part.
So the tech build was easy. Okay, cool.
In comparison, like the hard work begins when you actually launch.
Okay.
The damn thing.
Yeah.
And I remember people telling me this, but having no experience, I'm like, oh, how hard can it be? It'll be fine. You just, you know, just do some stuff and it'll work out.
Yeah.
Get hundreds of people subscribe overnight. No, that doesn't happen. And the technical part, if you're a non-technical founder like myself, you're going to go through a massive learning curve. You now know what a CTO stands for.
Yeah,
for
I was going to say, now you know.
Now you know what a back-end engineer does, what a front-end engineer does. UI, UX, the hell is that? I know now.
Oh, yeah.
And you also learn, you know, sprints.
Yep.
How often do you communicate with your tech team? Mm. And one of the things that we didn't have, because again, non-technical, we did not have clearly defined specifications.
Ah, right. Okay.
We kept adding and adding and adding. And it dragged and dragged and dragged. I was like, why the hell is this taking so long?
Yeah.
Without realizing the spec.
Yeah, yeah.
Because my idea of a spec, like when I went to the tech agency to help me build this, I went to them with 5 bullet points.
Yeah, you're like, here it is.
I need you to match. I need one for recruiters. I need one for hiring managers. Done. Easy.
Design here as well. Just if
my stick man.
Exactly. If these 5 bullet points didn't cover it, I've sketched it out here. Hopefully, if you're a visual learner, this will help.
Yeah. And, you know, they took that and they turned it to like 150 bullet points. So you really learn the nuances of all of that.
Incredible. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like there's learning in that, I think. And part of the challenge, right? Mm. Sprints. You're like, so you all want me to speak to you on a daily basis? Okay.
Yeah. One of the most challenging, but the most satisfying thing was sitting down with the tech guys and the product manager of it. And we sat there for 4 hours face to face in a room and we drew out the user journey.
Oh, incredible. Yeah. Great.
From when you click this to this to this, what pops up, what happens. When I tell you it hurt my brain for about 4 hours, but it was the most satisfying thing to do. And I would do that over and over again. Like it was so rewarding. Mm. And then I remember showing my mom, like, mom, when you press this button, it goes to this page.
Yeah.
And she, you know, I will never take for granted again.
Yeah.
When you press a button and it does the thing you want it to do. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Like absolutely brilliant. Because you have to put thought into tiny 100%. Things.
There must be a sense of real ownership of the DNA of the platform when you go to that. When you've seen it in that kind of micro detail.
Yeah.
You know what's happening, why, you know, what's happening throughout that kind of that particular tech platform and what's, you know, kind of catalyzed and what comes back around to the user.
Yeah.
It's just, it must be fascinating.
It was. And I think you need to be a part of that because there's no one else who's going to understand this product.
Yeah.
More than you. Even though I'm not a coder, I need to know exactly what the hell is going on here.
Because you're
going
to go and sell it.
Because I have to go and sell it. And I think the biggest high has probably happened in the past 5 months, and that is getting validation that your product works. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God. There's no better feeling than when I see that someone on the platform who has subscribed has had a placement made out of it. And that this was my only goal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that would be it.
That's wicked. As a founder, I think this kind of encapsulates what we were chatting about. What kind of 1, 2, or 3 traits do you think are essential to be a founder? I think we touched upon resilience being certainly one of those.
Yeah.
Is there anything else, any other trait that you think is important or you found you really, you know, kind of indexed highly on through this journey?
Creativity. 100%. And I don't mean creativity in the sense of coloring pencils, whatever. It's thinking outside the box when it comes to how you want to get your messaging across, what your messaging is going to be, what your story is going to be. Because everyone has told me everything is about stories, how you tell your story, who relates to your story. And if you have a creative way of thinking into how to reach those pockets or get people to relate to you, I think that's a really big advantage. Yeah, so creativity, resilience. The last one.
I think if I could venture,
yeah,
you look like you have fun. It does. It looks fun. Even I think some of the challenging things that you've shared on kind of socially, you're trying to look at the lighter side of it. You're not taking it so serious. It's like world ending. It's like, okay, look, this didn't quite go as I anticipated.
What would the word for that be? Where it's level headed, I reckon, or
I this is going to sound so corporate, but I think it's very much a solutions mindset. You're thinking, okay, that's the challenge, or that didn't quite go the way I anticipated.
Yeah.
But what is the solution to that? Yeah. You're not like, oh my God, it didn't work. We just need to stop.
No, that's not an option. And the thing when you mentioned about, you know, having fun, there are parts of the job that are not fun, of course, but if the majority of it, I've never complained about Rec Finder. I've mentioned when things are tough, but I've never complained.
For sure.
About it. Because I have no right to complain about my job. When I've chosen this path, I believe in what I do. I know what the mission is. And it's not that I don't have a right. I don't feel like I want to, because I still enjoy it. Even if a challenge comes up, the fun part happens when it's like, okay, well, how do we get out of it? Well, what's solution A, B to Z? What are we going to do here? And it's, you know, you get decision fatigue and you have all of these different options, but it's creating order out of chaos. And you're right. I think that's a good last one.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, it does sound a little bit corporate, but it feeds into that kind of creativity because you're having to think about solutions that are non-traditional. It may not
and
be the
use
things
your
that...
network for it. I think I never used to be able to ask for help. I was one of those people. I was never able to ask for help. And now, it's not that I don't have a choice. It's that I really, really value other people's opinion on things massively, because you never know what they're going to say that's going to influence what you do next. Or if someone, you know, a couple of months ago, someone mentioned SEIS to me. Oh, what the hell is that? Do I need to have that? Start Googling around. It's like, oh, just go here and get SEIS. Oh, okay, cool. Let's do that. Now I'm SEIS approved. All right, well, that was cool. If I didn't go and see John at that networking event, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, asking for help. Get out of your own way.
Yeah.
Get out of your own way and ask for help if you don't know something.
I think that talks to equally as well, active listening. You're listening, not just having conversations, you're listening and kind of looking to gain knowledge. Is that right for Rec Finder? Is that something that I need to be thinking about? You know, does that fit into perhaps the roadmap at some point? And on that, as a kind of question to close, what's the vision for the next 12 months of Rec Finder? what's on that roadmap?
Oh, that's a cheeky question. So I always fall into the trap of saying we. I don't know who this we is at Rec Finder.
We?
Me and my personalities. So the plan is to go for an angel round of investment in September.
Heard it here first, folks. If you want to get on early. Yeah, if you want to get on board now to the first round, angel round, you need to start dropping DMs to Alex now, because you're going to be in a queue.
And having looked at the product market fit, and we know what we want to do next based on the feedback, the information, everything, it's massively exciting what we're looking to do next with it. And that's hopefully going to be the plan for the next 12 months is enhancing the product.
Incredible. Incredible. Yeah. Well, genuinely, I know you're going to be successful for sure. I mean, I'm not even wishing you every success. I know you're going to be successful.
Thank you.
But thank you very much, Alex, for joining me on the Never Mind Jobs Factor podcast. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise, it's been so much fun. Thank you so much.